to negate negotiations with the missile test. They're simply trying to shake the bars, as it were.
That is the senior director of the Korea Society on another day of North Korean missile test. It's Friday, May 10th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. You can join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, trade talks are underway between the U.S. and China with heavy new tariffs being threatened. We explore the latest in the battle over international 5G and how malnutrition is spreading through Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh camps. It is all on today's VOA Asia. South Korea's military says North Korea fired what appears to be two short-range ballistic missiles Thursday, the second time Pyongyang fired missiles in less than a week. One of the projectiles traveled 420 kilometers, the other 270 kilometers. The South Korean statement added the missiles were launched from North Pyongan province in the country's northwest and flew eastward. At the White House Thursday, President Trump said nobody is happy about the development, adding that he doesn't believe North Korea is ready to negotiate. South Korea's presidential Blue House said it's very worried about the apparent short-range missile launch, adding it does not help inter-Korean military tensions. South Korean officials say Seoul has increased security preparations in case of additional launches. Joining us on VOA Asia is Dr. Stephen Norper, the senior director of the Korea Society and a professor at Columbia University. Dr. Norper, in your opinion, what's driving this change of direction as far as North Korea is concerned?
Well, what North Korea is trying to do in the wake of the failed Hanoi summit is up the ante and try to increase leverage, in particular with the Americans. So the short-range missile tests are worrisome, but at the same time, they're not intermediate or long-range missile tests. So they're just within the realm of what they consider acceptability and not a violation, in their opinion, of the moratorium. That said, because they're ballistic, they, as South Korea has pointed out, may be violations of UN sanctions.
What can the United States really do as far as reaction to this other than what's been said already?
Well, the U.S. has concerns and certainly is at full readiness along with South Korea as they weigh options in terms of how to respond. That said, it's important not to overplay the aspect because the negotiation table is where the North Koreans want to be. They're not trying to negate negotiations with the missile test. They're simply trying to shake the bars, as it were. And so we'll have to see what happens next in terms of Washington's response. Secretary of State Pompeo is on the way back. And it looks like they'll be discussing this issue, certainly with the South Koreans as well. And it's concerning, but not overly so relative to the fact that it's not a long-range missile test or a break in the nuclear moratorium.
It has been said by some that Kim Jong-un is playing Donald Trump. Do you agree?
Well, he's playing Donald Trump, but he's also trying to take the time to sort out their own next steps. And he, being Kim Jong-un, was clearly caught by surprise by Trump's walk away from Hanoi. And so, again, this is designed to sort of get attention, to rattle the bars without going too far. That said, the Americans now have also announced that they have a North Korean cargo ship that they're returning off the U.S. coast. This was seized last year, and so it's not a new story per se, but the announcement of it is designed to say to North Korea, sanctions enforcement is in effect.
What's next? Do you consider this brinksmanship on either side or both sides, and what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, it is on both sides, and it's a reminder to the international community that tensions can flare, and we don't want to be back where we were in 2017 with the discussion about a military strike and very high tensions on both sides. So we need to be cautious here not to overreact and to read it as a security concern and a potential violation, but at the same time, an effort to get to the negotiating table. And so that really behooves us to say, you know, it's serious. The security threat is serious. Let's see what we can do to get a third round between the North Korean and U.S. leaders going and to try out to allow room for South Korea's peace offensive to take hold. And that includes demilitarization and confidence building measures.
And is that a possibility?
That's certainly what the South Koreans are thinking, and President Moon Jae-in has banked his presidency on a warming with the North Koreans, just as they've now struck a military thumb at the United States and South Korea, so too they've been ignoring South Korea's diplomatic overtures. But this whole process started to work around the Pyeongchang Olympics and around South Koreans' efforts to get North Korea to the table. So for this to continue, North Korea is going to have to back down and reapproach the negotiating table with Trump, and all roads lead through Seoul, meaning Moon Jae-in's calm, steady rudder on this process.
What is the possibility of North Korea ever giving up its nuclear program?
Well, the consensus of the U.S. intelligence community and the military intelligence community beyond that is that it's unlikely that they would give up the entirety of their nuclear capability. That said, that's no reason not to push for denuclearization, and whether this rather long process of denuclearization begins with partial denuclearization, with declarations and verifications of some facilities, progress in arms control discussions, it's a start. And clearly the moratorium is a start, and one that the White House has announced has been to this point a success. So that continued moratorium and a step beyond towards denuclearization is really all important, given the lethality of North Korea's missile and nuclear capabilities.
What's the possibility of a reduction in sanctions in the near future?
I think the United States would probably be prepared to enter into some partial lifting of sanctions, in particular on the front where it involved inter-Korean economic cooperation. So if South Korea was to make the request to the Security Council, that would probably be what was needed. And all of those sanctions resolutions have language built in for the partial relief of those over time, and again, in the presence of good faith. And we're not seeing that with this current round of tests. But if we can get there, that's the aspiration. I think the only thing I'd add is that clearly the U.S. Trade negotiations with China and the downtick in that is something the North Koreans are watching. They're also watching the situation with Iran. And so while those are heavy foreign policy distractors for the United States, along with Venezuela and other issues, the North Koreans are trying to gauge U.S. Insistence and follow through by what's happening with China on the economic front and with Iran on the nuclear front. So we will we'll have to see what influences those are. But if China and the United States ratchet up the trade war, if there's a lack of cooperation, that actually hurts the inter-Korean process and stability on the peninsula, because it means the two would be at odds as opposed to trying to strike a common understanding for how to get North Korea to the negotiating table. And in that sense, the large powers play an important role.
Stephen Norper, Senior Director of the Korea Society and a professor at Columbia University in New York. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. The Taliban and the United States have concluded week-long negotiations in Qatar, but reported no significant progress toward advancing peace efforts in Afghanistan. Officials in Pakistan say Islamic organizations have agreed to put some 30,000 madrasas or seminaries under the supervision of the Ministry of Education, part of that government's efforts to curb violent extremism in the country. North Korea Thursday denied the existence of political prison camps in the country as it faced fierce criticism of its rights record at the United Nations. Four prisoners were killed during a riot at a northern Myanmar jail, according to officials, coming on the heels of an amnesty which saw more than 6,000 inmates released. This is VOA Asia. As we continue, China says it's made all necessary preparations if the United States follows through on a pledge to impose a new set of tariffs on Chinese goods, as its chief trade negotiator arrived in Washington for another round of talks aimed at ending its trade war. Vice Premier Liu He, President Xi's Jinping's top economic advisor, was scheduled to sit down with U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin Thursday evening, a day before tariffs increased from 10 to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joins us via Skype. Steve, President Trump had quite a bit to say Thursday during an impromptu news conference.
There were quite a few statements that he made. Perhaps most significantly, he said, quote, "We're starting that paperwork today," referring to the new, what he called, very heavy tariffs that are due to go into effect on Chinese products coming into the United States from Friday. And the official notice is now out by the Customs and Border Protection Service. So unless something spectacular happens in the next few hours with these trade talks, these tariffs, which will raise from 10% to 25% the cost of importing Chinese goods into this country, about $200 billion worth of products, will go into effect.
As he usually does, the U.S. president made sure that people knew how friendly he was with the Chinese leader.
I like the president a lot. He's a friend of mine. But I'm representing the USA, and he's representing China. And we're not going to be taken advantage of anymore. We're not going to pay China $500 billion a year. So we put very heavy tariffs on China as of Friday, and we put them on also 8 months ago.
So the president mentioning that he had received a beautiful letter, presumably this week, from the Chinese president Xi Jinping, that essentially expressed a sentiment of let's work together. And the president in the past has also spoken glowingly about receiving letters from Kim Jong-un.
Steve, the talks were scheduled to get underway about 5 o'clock. What do you hear is going on now?
Presumably, they are still talking. And not only is President Xi's right-hand man, the vice premier, leading the talks for the Chinese delegation, but the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are also there. And there's been this shuttling going on between Beijing and Washington for really some months now to try to sort this out. And there were indications that we were getting very close until just a few days ago when the president took to Twitter and said things were not going well, accusing the Chinese essentially of backtracking. Now, Beijing, of course, has a different view and is also threatening retaliation in kind if these tariffs do go into effect from tomorrow.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. As always, Steve, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Ira.
Remember, you can follow the progress of the talks on our website at voanews.com and our social media platforms. Happening now in Asia, U.S. authorities have seized a North Korean cargo vessel for allegedly violating U.S. and U.N. sanctions by transporting coal from an East Asian country. The Justice Department said in a statement the ship was approaching U.S. territorial waters when it was first confiscated in April of 2018 by foreign maritime authorities in Indonesia. This is VOA Asia. Earlier this month, officials from a group of 30 countries agreed to take a more coordinated approach to secure the next generation of fast mobile communication networks known as 5G. The United States and others worry that technology companies located in countries with governments like China's could be subject to state influence, making the networks insecure. Elizabeth Lee reports on the security concerns over 5G and what it means to consumers.
5G mobile technology is supposed to be faster, more responsive, and make the world a more connected place. It also gives 5G companies a whole lot of power, says Svi Miron of the technology company BATM Advanced Communications.
That whoever controls the internet or supply the whole ecosystem around the internet basically controls the world of communication.
Speaking at the Milken Institute Global Conference, Maron says with that kind of power, having Chinese 5G technology in the U.S. is a real security risk.
They put all kind of small, dangerous midgets inside their equipment that can be called in time of conflicts. If there is a conflict and the Chinese will decide to paralyze your equipment, to collapse your communication system. Basically, they can do it. And this is the danger.
Maron says China is using mobile technology as a tool for spying. And he's seen the evidence.
They are actually using it for massive surveillance against their own population. We looked on the Huawei equipment to the level of every single chip there, and what we found is not very pleasant. This is not a commercial company stuff. This is a kind of nearly a military grade stuff.
On the topic of Chinese technology, at another conference panel, Jihua Tung of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference says technology such as artificial intelligence and 5G in China are intended for the common good.
These are intended not to spy on other people. These are intended to help Chinese people to generate more income and become part of a developed nation.
But a report from Human Rights Watch says China has been using a mobile app for mass surveillance in Xinjiang, home to many Uyghurs, a Muslim minority group subjected to mass detention and religious repression. The report says biometric data, including DNA and blood types, have been recorded, and location data is used to monitor the movement of people. Many U.S. officials fear China will use similar methods of surveillance outside its own borders. Tung says China does not intend to expand its power.
We understand the pain of being occupied. We understand the cost, the pain of war. That's why, you know, we have more DNA in our skin, in our body, for peace. If you look carefully about all the wars that China has fought, it's more defensive than anything else.
Many technology experts say the West needs to take a defensive approach and beef up its cybersecurity to protect itself against any potential threats from 5G technology. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Coming your way, at the malnourished Rohingya in Bangladesh. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Asian airlines are cutting routes, revamping their schedules, and leasing extra aircraft to fill gaps left by the grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX 8s after deadly crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia killed 346 people. You're listening to VOA Asia. Special steps are being taken to help severely malnourished children in the Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh. As Dave Grunebaum reports from Cox's Bazar, these measures are necessary to prevent the children from suffering long-term consequences.
This child is getting her height checked, body weighed, and the circumference of an upper arm measured. She's dangerously thin. About 11% of children younger than 5 in the Rohingya refugee camps in southern Bangladesh have moderate to severe acute malnutrition. These children are at increased risk of stunted growth as well as death. Moderate and severe acute malnutrition can also have severe detrimental impact on a child's brain development.
From pregnancy until the child is 2 years of age, that's 1,000 days. The child is not fed well, and the child's brain will not develop well, and that will affect their educational consequences. That will affect their productive, you know, capacities as they grow up in the future.
More than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims fled to southern Bangladesh from neighboring Myanmar because of a military campaign in 2017 that United Nations investigators say was executed with genocidal intent, accusations Myanmar denies. The refugees now live in sprawling camps dependent on humanitarian aid for basic needs. There are 85 nutrition centers across the camps, including this one run by Save the Children. Kids with severe acute malnutrition are fed special therapeutic food full of protein, vitamins, and minerals. This 11-month-old boy was diagnosed with severe acute malnutrition just 3 weeks before we met him, but has shown rapid improvement.
Now we're getting help with nutrition, and my son is healthier, and he seems happy too.
There are fruit and vegetable stands in the camps, but many families cannot afford them because they do not have anyone working. There's nutrient-enriched porridge available for all children 5 and under, because the only other food items handed out to many families are rice and lentils.
Is rice and lentils enough to provide proper nutrition?
No, not at all, because it's not a balanced diet, not only for the children, also for the adult, but especially for the children, it is very important to have diversified food. But the situation is changing.
About one-third of the refugees are in families that receive electronic cards with a credit updated monthly to use the specific food markets in the camps where fruits and vegetables are sold. More outlets are scheduled to be built, and the World Food Program expects all the families to have the cards by the end of the year. Meantime, the work continues to try to help Rohingya children in these refugee camps have healthy diets. It's a fight with high stakes. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Thailand's election commission officially endorsed results from that country's March 24th general election this week, declaring that the Pheutai Party, associated with fugitive former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, topped the field by winning 136 constituencies. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia. In India, the country's first political crowdfunding platform is making a start by helping some candidates raise funds in a transparent manner. Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi reports on the small but significant initiative.
Seeking support from voters in a low-income neighborhood in the Indian capital, Atishi Marlena promises change. The first-time candidate for parliament waded into the noisy din of national politics after steering reforms that dramatically lifted education standards in Delhi's government schools.
And I think I realized that if you elect the right people into the right decision-making positions, then it can have a substantial impact on the lives of people.
This Rhodes scholar is a candidate of the Aam Aadmi Party. Born 6 years ago on an anti-corruption plank, it lacks the deep pockets of mainstream parties. To finance her campaign, Atishi has used India's first political crowdfunding platform launched in January.
For the last 4 months, our biggest takeaway is that we've at least been able to put together two strong candidates who have funded their entire campaign with crowdfunded money. This Lok Sabha election has established enough that if you've worked over the last 5 years to build enough social and political capital online, you can convert it into raising funds for yourself.
Besides Atishi, the startup has raised funds for Kanhaiya Kumar, a firebrand student leader. Each has got about $100,000, the cap set by the Election Commission for campaign spending. An increasingly digital India is pulling in donors from all strata. A rickshaw puller, students, ordinary citizens wanting more grassroots people in politics, those who cannot fund expensive campaigns. According to surveys, the 2019 Indian election will cost $8 billion, which could be the world's highest. That price tag is not helping.
Are we getting elected better people? No. There is no evidence of that. On the contrary, each election you see the number of super rich is increasing and the number of criminal background people is increasing. So which means, what does that mean? We are getting into a flawed democracy scenario.
Much of the political funding comes from big corporates. But with over 400 million Indians having smartphones, that dependence could be reduced.
Instead of, say, a set of 20 people, sponsoring the entire political system, we can have 20 million people sponsoring the political system.
When you take money from big businesses, big corporations, if you get elected into power, then you owe them a lot of favors. Their ordinary people have funded my election, so I can easily work and constantly work in the interests of ordinary people.
If even one candidate backed by a crowd-funded campaign makes it to parliament, it could encourage more to tread the same path. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zineb Abdul-Rahman. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.